Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Plenty coming up on this edition. We'll look at the challenges facing German businesses as the political uncertainty there continues and Nissan announces 9,000 job cuts around the world. We hear what's going wrong at the Japanese auto giant.
Nissan has been a company in trouble for the past 5 years. They've consistently missed production targets and profit targets, and the biggest worry, if you talk to folks at Nissan, is what's happening in the US.
Plenty more to come on that story. But this week, we've been talking a lot about the world's largest economy, haven't we? And we've been talking a lot about inflation. It was one of the key issues, if not the key issue, in the US elections. Well, we've got a clearer picture of the challenge it poses to the world's largest economy a few hours ago, when the chair of the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, spoke about interest rates, which were at 4.75%.
Inflation has eased substantially from a peak of 7% to 2.1% as of September. We are committed to maintaining our economy's strength by supporting maximum employment and returning inflation to our 2% goal. Today, the FOMC decided to take another step in reducing the degree of policy restraint by lowering our policy interest rate by a quarter percentage point.
Okay, if you're wondering what the FOMC is, the Federal Open Market Committee. Let's bring in Dana Peterson, chief economist at the Conference Board. She's in New York. Dana, no surprise that we saw this interest rate cut. A lot of focus is on what Jerome Powell says after that. What was the picture he was painting of the US economy just a couple of days after that vote, which showed so many people were unhappy with their position in it?
Sure. I mean, the Fed was looking forward and backward. Looking backward, they were saying, look, the economy is still pretty strong. GDP was 2.8% in the third quarter. That's really outstanding. The labor market is solid. Those are his words. Unemployment rate's low, even though we only had a few payroll gains. A lot of it was disrupted or by hurricanes and also strikes. The key thing is inflation. And yes, inflation gauges have slowed materially. They're not at target yet, but they're very close. But it's the price level. The price level for consumers is very high. When you add up all the cumulative increases, and certainly in our consumer confidence measure, in our survey, consumers are still writing in about inflation and prices as being something impacting the economy.
He talked again, didn't he, about getting it right, not reducing those interest rates too quickly. Did you get a sense of how many more interest rate cuts we could see over the next few months?
Sure, absolutely. Looking forward, the Fed indicated that at least for this year, the balance of this year, which is really just one more meeting in December, the elections will not have an impact on policy, which makes sense because nothing will change until 2025 when the new administration comes in. To that extent, we think the Fed can still cut, 25 basis points in December if the data collaborate, if the data cooperate. However, next year, it's very uncertain. We basically had the Fed cutting 25 basis points at every meeting until the Fed funds target range dropped to 3% to 3.25%. And we thought we'd get there around the middle of next year. I'm not so sure anymore. Certainly, if we do have big changes in policy, it's going to have material implications on growth and inflation. Some of those policies may raise growth and raise inflation or do the opposite. So certainly things that are inflationary would be if we have another round of new tariffs and trade wars in the U.S. And that certainly would, I think, slow down the pace of interest rate cuts. But again, if we do have, another debt ceiling debacle or the tax cliff, the Fed might actually accelerate interest rate cuts. It's really not clear. It's really what you want to bake into your base case.
Yeah. He did talk about that, didn't he? He said, look, I don't really want to talk about tariffs or the future policies of the next administration. Let's quickly stay with us, Dan. I want to bring in Walter Todd, President and Chief Investment Officer, Greenwood Capital. We've seen all week, haven't we, Walter, that the markets have responded pretty positively to that election result. How have they responded to what Jerome Powell has been saying?
Yeah, well, good evening from the U.S. They were kind of volatile as he was talking this afternoon, but, the Dow closed at a record high, the S&P closed at a record high, the Nasdaq closed at a record high, so you can't get much better than that.
You cannot indeed. I want you both now to have a listen to something else that Jerome Powell was asked about repeatedly at his press conference.
Hi, Victoria Guida with Politico. Some of the president-elect's advisors have suggested that you should resign. If he asked you to leave, would you go?
No.
Legally, you're not required to leave?
No.
To follow up on Victoria's question, do you believe the president has the power to fire or demote you, and has the Fed determined the legality of a president demoting at will any of the other governors with leadership positions?
Not permitted under the law. Not permitted under the law.
Pretty clear there, Dana, from Jerome Powell about what he thinks. But this question is going to keep coming up, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. You know, ever since its inception, the Fed has always been the focus of policymakers, you know, fiscal policymakers in Washington. And certainly there probably will be more pressures on the Fed coming to the fore. But again, Congress has given the Fed legally independence from political influence. And so the Fed's going to continue to operate with its dual mandate in mind, that's 2% inflation and maximum employment, and also financial stability. So with those things, I think the Fed can continue to do its work. And again, legally, it does not have to bend to the will of any political pressures.
It's important to remember here, isn't it, Walter, that Jerome Powell is a Donald Trump appointment.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he was definitely prepared to answer that question. I mean, you could tell actually watching him, he was just waiting for someone to ask it and wanted to answer it. But yeah, you're correct. I mean, they did go back and forth during Donald Trump's first term, especially in 2018, as they were raising rates and Trump wanted them to lower rates. So this is, you know, not unusual to see some jawboning, but certainly the Fed's independence is a question mark in this second term, because it's been talked about on the campaign trail.
Dana, final question to you on this particular section. We're looking at the figures again, aren't we? And we're talking about interest rate cuts, the level of inflation. One thing the election showed us was, in spite of the figures telling us the economy is doing well, a lot of people didn't feel that, did they? There's a gap between the figures and the perception of many Americans' lives.
I don't think there's a gap, because there's a difference between inflation, which is the rate of change, and prices, which is the level. So consumers do notice that prices are not rising as quickly. And that shows up in our inflation expectations gauge, which has fallen from really high levels to something that's probably more normal. But it's the prices, and it's all the cumulative increases in prices that consumers are still worried about. They're still complaining about that. Bread costs more, you know, in dollars and cents than it did before the pandemic. And that's really weighing on consumers. The interesting thing is that in our measure, our consumer confidence measure, we ask a lot about jobs. And so our measure has been pretty upbeat because consumers are working. But in the bowels of the report, when it comes to inflation, we're still getting some inflation and prices, the level, we're still getting some negative readings.
Dana, thanks as always for joining us here on World Business Report. Let's stay with the U.S. economy, because we're now in that period of speculation about what economic policies the Trump administration will actually implement from the ones that they have been talking about. And who'll be the next Treasury Secretary? That's the person who makes decisions about the economy in the U.S. Well, the governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, has said he'll be watching what the new Trump administration does with keen interest.
I think it's important that we see what the policies that the new Trump administration decides to announce are, and we're not. But yeah, just to reiterate the point, we're an open economy, so we obviously watch international markets very carefully. They do have an effect, certainly, as we were saying earlier, on the UK curve. So we do obviously have a lot of interest in what goes on, internationally, and particularly in the US. So we'll be watching it very carefully.
Let's talk about Donald Trump's favorite word, tariffs. Wilbur Ross was U.S. Commerce Secretary under Donald Trump the last time he was in office.
Well, the threat of tariffs is important. The threat of tariffs on automobiles last time clearly resulted in a migration of some factories to the U.S. And this time, his threat of tariffs on Chinese EVs clearly has led to their wanting to relocate some production to Mexico and places of that sort.
Let's bring in Everett Eisenstadt, former Deputy Director of the National Economic Council of the U.S. and a former Donald Trump trade advisor. Everett, thanks so much for joining us here on World Business Report. But before we talk about tariffs, we've been getting over the last 48 hours lots of reaction to the election result. What did these results tell us about the U.S. economy, do you think?
Well, I think you know, as was noted just a few minutes ago, I think people are quite concerned about prices. I mean, I was in the shopping just the other day, and it really hit me how high the price of food is. And I think that really impacts the consumer and probably the voter across the country.
Yeah, that certainly was a message that came through loud and clear. Donald Trump now beginning preparations for his next administration. He's just announced that Susan Summerall will be his chief of staff. Not a major surprise there, I think. What do you expect him to do? Let's start with tariffs. He talked a lot about those increases. Will he put all of them in place, or was that just a negotiating tool?
I think it's much more than a negotiating tool. I mean, as Secretary Ross noted, tariffs were used very aggressively during the first administration. And I think the president's been pretty transparent about his intent to use tariffs. There's a number of reasons that he could do that and a number of rationales behind it. But he clearly sees tariffs as an effective tool to effectuate an economic policy outcome. So I think it's going to be part of his agenda. And you asked about, you know, what did the election tell us? Well, one thing it told us is that he won the popular vote. And that is the first time we've seen a Republican president win the popular vote in quite some time. The fact that he was so transparent about using tariffs really is almost a mandate from the people that they know he's going to do it. He received the most votes. There's not a lot of checks on that, on the use of tariffs right now.
When you used to talk to him about global trade and you talked to him about tariffs and their implications they could have for the global economy, what would he say to you? What would those discussions, how would they go?
Well, I mean, I would never, you know, talk about any interactions we had in that way. But I do think that there is an understanding that tariffs have an impact. And one of the impacts that I believe he's seeking to achieve, and not speaking on his behalf, is that he really wants to attract investment in industrial industry, you know, industry back to the United States. And as, you know, Secretary Ross said, it has had that impact. And certainly in relationship to China, where there was a migration of industrial jobs to China over a number of years, we'd like to get, and he would like to get those jobs back, and sees tariffs as one way to do that.
Stay with us, Everett. I want to bring in Walter Todd here. Is the market getting a little, well, there's no signs of it, let's be honest about it, the way that it keeps going up and up and up. But could they get more jittery if those tariffs led to retaliation against U.S. companies like Apple and Tesla in China?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And actually, if you kind of look at how the market reacted in certain areas yesterday, there was the implication that there is concern about these tariffs. So if you look at retailers, for example, like the dollar stores here in the U.S. or Best Buy that are heavily reliant on imported goods, they were down pretty significantly, even as the market was up quite dramatically. So you're starting to see the market kind of game out what might happen. I would just note, if Trump were to implement the rates of tariffs that he said on the campaign trail, the weighted average tariff on imported goods would be close to 20%, which is about equivalent to the Smoot-Hawley rate in 1930. That did not end too well. So I don't think we want to go there, but I understand the concept of using them as a negotiating tactic. But I think they're going to be, you know, quite a bit less than the numbers thrown around on the campaign trail.
Yeah, Everett, that is what a lot of people have said. But you're not sure about that. You think he actually could implement them at the levels he's been talking about?
Well, I mean, we'll wait. That has, you know, yet to be seen. But I think he has someone who generally does what he says, and this is something he campaigned on. So to presume otherwise, I think, would be, underestimating a potential significant event. Now, tariffs are not, you know, universal tariff is not easy to implement. It's got a lot of impacts, as was noted. There needs to be time to prepare. So how it's done and when it's done could have quite a significant effect on, you know, the ultimate tariff rate that goes into effect.
But they will be inflationary, won't they?
Yes, I think I'm not, you know, an economist, but I understand that, you know, you increase prices and it can have an inflationary impact. At the same time, there's other, as was noted, there's many other policies that he'll undertake, including on taxes and deregulation, that could have a deflationary impact. So It's hard to say, you know, in isolation that they will definitively lead to higher inflation.
Final question for you. Even if you put tariffs in place, because there's a different range of tariffs, say, on China and other countries, it doesn't mean that all that manufacturing will come back to the U.S. It could go to another country, maybe Vietnam, which has a lower level of tariffs.
That's certainly possible. I mean, one of the things that it's a really important lesson from the first administration is that the debate over tariffs is very real, and their relationship to U.S. economic policy is really very significant in this current environment. However, he has and shown in the past that, you know, moving forward with tariffs had led to discussions with other countries about rebalancing trade relationships, and I would not be surprised to see something similar to that occur under this term.
Listen, thank you so much for joining us here on World Business Report and giving us your insight there on that issue that a lot of people are talking about, tariffs. You can contact us on WhatsApp if you have any views on what Donald Trump should do with tariffs. Should he implement them or should he not? On +44 330 678 3033. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. We have spent a lot of time talking about the world's largest economy. Let's move to Europe's largest economy now, Germany, where the three-party coalition has collapsed after ministers from the Free Democrats quit the government. The exit came after the Chancellor Olaf Scholz sacked his finance minister. He said Christian Lindner, who leads the Free Democrats, had broken his trust too often, making serious government work impossible. The former finance minister, though, called for an earlier confidence vote during a conference in Berlin.
Our country needs a government that not only holds office, but can act. The right thing for our country would be an immediate vote of confidence and new elections. No one in a democracy should be afraid of the voters. Quick new elections after the failed Scholz government are not only important for democracy, our country must not waste any time. Citizens must now have the opportunity to make decisions about the direction of their future themselves.
Nina Haas-Trowbridge is the chief political correspondent with the German broadcaster Deutsche Welle.
There had been so much infighting. There had been so many accusations going in all directions. And the bottom line was always that Christian Lindner had very different ideas of how to run an economy when you compare that to the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz from the Social Democrats and the Vice Chancellor Robert Habeck from the Greens, who's the economy minister. So these three men essentially battled it out on the open stage, and this was becoming unbearable.
So how are businesses reacting to this political uncertainty? Many are already struggling. Andres Ruter is the German country head of Atlex Partners, an international business advisory firm.
It is even worse, and they are very much concerned. I spoke to a couple of them today. Until a new government will be in place, this time of uncertainty is not helping in the already very difficult situation.
When you spoke to those businesses, how quickly do they think that the political situation could be resolved? Because we may not have an election until March next year.
Yeah, so many of them are now reaching out to their political contacts in Berlin to push for a far earlier election, because basically an election next year in March would mean the government will be in place before summertime, and then you have the summer break. So basically a well-functioning government will be in place only in three quarter of a year, and that is definitely too late. So anything to accelerate this would be key, because there are many daunting obstacles for German companies: bureaucracy reduction, energy price structure, infrastructure, but also things like negotiation of trade agreements and so on, which becomes important following the election in the US now, and how to react on this.
You're dealing with many businesses at the moment, aren't you, who, because of the economic challenges that Germany is facing, are looking to restructure their business. Is that growing? Are you getting more and more companies coming to you saying, hey, we've got problems, we need help?
Absolutely. And many companies turn to us for financial restructuring, but also for transformational restructuring, which is, where do we produce in the future? And do we move production units out of Germany and or even further away in the U.S., given the new government in the U.S.? So there's lots of transformation. And for this transformation needs this reliability and support of a stable government is so crucial. But yes, to answer your question, the demand for our restructuring work has been significant up.
When you're having those discussions about where they should be based, and of course, Germany has this huge manufacturing industry, so I'm sure you're speaking to some of those companies as well. What tends to be the answers that you and the firms are coming up with? Is it to stay in Germany or go elsewhere?
Well, if you address this question from an economical point of view, then unfortunately, very often the solution is to go there where core industries are, and that's for chemicals industry and automotive industry, it's China. And for many other companies, it will be Mexico, close to the US or Eastern Europe, and also Spain, Portugal have been countries more nearshore.
I know you've just written a piece talking about German pessimism. There seems to be quite a lot to be pessimistic about at the moment, politically and economically. Do you think things are going to improve? Many people worry about the long-term future of, let's say, the automobile industry in Germany.
I was writing about the German angst versus German mood, so German anxiety versus German bravery. And unfortunately, we collectively view the extent of a crisis much worse than many others do.
A lot of people are calling Germany the sick man of Europe. Is there a cure on the horizon?
Absolutely. We had Agenda 2010 with our Chancellor Schröder back then. If we would get a government in place which has a clear commitment to invest in infrastructure, get the energy prices down and the bureaucracy reduction quickly, then of course the fundamentals in the countries are still good. You need clear commitment, and coalition we had before definitely won't make it.
Walter, we've been talking a lot about the US, how it can get manufacturing back for Europe's powerhouse in manufacturing. Germany, it's difficult to maintain it facing that Chinese challenge.
Yeah, for sure. We have a BMW plant here in South Carolina where I live, so we're big fans of the German automobile sector. But yeah, certainly perfect storm. Energy with Ukraine, China slowing down, major trading partner, and now China competition on the EV side. So not an easy fix. Going to have to spend some money and maybe run a deficit, which I know they don't like to do.
Well, they're not allowed to do, are they, under that debt brake that we talked about on the program yesterday? The Japanese car giant Nissan has announced plans to cut 9,000 jobs from its global workforce and reduce its production capacity by 20%. Sean McLean reports on EV companies and Asian automakers for the Wall Street Journal. He told me why the company is struggling.
Nissan has been a company in trouble for the past 5 years. They have consistently missed production targets and profit targets. And behind the brand that everybody knows and sees on the road today, we have a car company that's really struggling to develop products and release them into the market in a timely fashion. And you're seeing the result of that today.
Are there particular markets that they're struggling in? Let's talk about the world's two big markets. How are they doing in China and how are they doing in the US?
Well, China, I think, like a lot of foreign automakers, have really struggled to keep pace, particularly when it comes to EVs or new energy vehicles like plug-in hybrids. They're really falling behind local brands. That's not a new problem for Nissan, but Nissan historically has been strong in China. So you're seeing them struggle more acutely, perhaps, than the other car makers. The biggest worry, if you talk to folks at Nissan, is what's happening in the U.S. Nissan, at one point, had a high watermark of 10% of the U.S. auto industry, and they are well below that today. In fact, Nissan's total global production has fallen from around 6 million to about 3 million today over the past 6 years.
Could things be about to get a bit tougher for them in that U.S. market with tariffs coming in, or do they have a lot of production inside the U.S.?
They have a lot of production in the U.S. I think Nissan's bigger problem is having the right product available. So Nissan was, of course, people who might remember the Nissan Leaf, one of the first movers when it came to electric vehicles. They, however, consciously decided to avoid developing a larger array of EVs while other automakers were more aggressive. So you're seeing the result of that today. In markets where EV sales are picking up, they're falling behind. And in the US, one thing that they say they didn't anticipate is a surge, an absolute surge in demand for hybrid vehicles. And the great irony of that is that Nissan also developed a hybrid system that it has had for sale in Japan and in Europe for the better part of 6-7 years, but they have not brought it to the U.S.
Even if they were now to re-pivot, can they compete against those Chinese car makers?
Well, most car makers aren't quite sure what they want to do with China. It's hard to abandon a car industry that sells, 29 million vehicles a year. However, they are falling so far behind when it comes to price and the cost of producing these vehicles that I don't know if there's an easy answer to that question. However, in the U.S., where Nissan is competitive, and in Europe, where Nissan is competitive, that's where you're going to see them concentrate their efforts. But the big question is whether or not they can actually grow their share here, because one thing that the CEO has talked about is increasing their brand power, and that sort of very nebulous marketing term about whether or not somebody wants to pay more or less for a vehicle. And that is something Nissan has struggled with for decades.
Sean McLean there talking about Nissan. Walter, we know that you like German cars. Americans traditionally have loved their Japanese cars, though, haven't they?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think, but Toyota really kind of dominates the market here. They really pivoted hard to hybrids, which you talked about there just a minute ago, and those have been very popular. So, I don't see many Nissan cars on the road, honestly, here in the U.S., more Toyota.
Yep, the Toyota, the world's best-selling brand of cars. Walter, thank you so much for joining us, guiding us as we continue to analyze the fallout from those U.S. elections. What will they mean for the global economy? And of course, we have had that decision by the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, to cut interest rates by 0.25%. More analysis of it all on Business Matters in a couple of hours' time, but that is it for World Business Report.